If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
This is the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. If you're playing Trivial Pursuit, does anybody actually do that anymore? You might find that Sarah Josepha Hale was the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb, a verse infamous as the best Thomas Edison could come up with for the very first ever recorded words, and as an explanation for Mary's predilection for mint jelly. Now, if that's all there was to Hale's story, we could pretty much wrap this segment up right here. But there is more. Oh, there is so much more, and Thanksgiving is just a part of it. And to tell that story and explain why we're telling it now is Melanie Kirkpatrick, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, former deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. More to the point for us, she is the author of Lady Editor, the story of Sarah Josepha Hale and the making of the modern American woman, as well as Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. It's good to have you with us, Melanie. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And it's wonderful to be with you.
And before we get to Hale's role in Thanksgiving, and it is a significant one, let's get some background. Your book starts with tragedy, the night her husband became ill, leading to his death.
Hale is, in my view, the most influential woman in American history. But she was a celebrity in the 19th century, but hardly anybody knows her today. She was a New Englander from New Hampshire, married a lawyer, had four kids, and the fifth was on the way when her husband died, leaving her with these children, and she was desperate to figure out how to raise them and educate them. Her husband had thought she was a good writer, so she decided she would try to sell some of her work. And she was successful at that, moderately, but it wasn't enough on which to raise her kids. And then she wrote a book, a novel called, a novel about slavery. And remember, this was 25 or so years before Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it was successful. And as a result of the success of that novel, it came out in 1827, she was asked to edit a new magazine for women. It went on to become the most popular magazine of the pre-Civil War era. It's known as Godey's Ladies Book, and many of our listeners probably know of it because it was famous for its fashion spreads. But beyond fashion, Hale made it a real intellectual journal. She wrote about education for women, about employment for women, and about women who worked at home needing more respect for their profession.
You know, it brings up something of a paradox before we get to the rest of her story and her Thanksgiving connection, which is extremely strong. Even though she was for women's education and women being able to work and for so many women's rights and all, she was also thought that it was very important in terms of what a woman's role was in marriage and the home. And the reason I started by asking you about the tragedy of her husband dying while she's pregnant with her fifth child is, if he had not died or if she had remarried, we might not be talking about her at all today.
You're absolutely right. And because she was a widow, and I think she chose to be a widow, Gil, instead of remarrying, because she was a widow, that meant she had more legitimacy in society. For example, in the law, under the law back then, a wife's possessions were the property of her husband, and her husband decided what to do with them. So when Hale became an editor in 1828, that meant she could act for herself. She could commission articles, she could pay authors, she could run this magazine, something that would have been very difficult for her to do if she had a husband.
But even in terms, and show how influential and important she was, even in terms of men's magazines at that time, commissioning new works was not something that was going on. America's culture at that time was still expressed mainly in terms of what was going on in Europe. And even these, you know, fairly influential men's magazines at the time were just something that somebody found when the boat came with a bunch of British magazines and they cut and pasted it into a magazine. And there you have it. She was commissioning new stuff from authors who had become, you know, an important part of American literature.
You know, you're right. In addition to her work in making education for women acceptable and desirable, she had a huge influence on the development of American media. She believed that our country had been unified by the Revolution, unified politically, but not culturally. And so Hale set out to make her magazine about America and about American culture, to help develop an American culture. And that meant literature, it meant food, it meant fashion, and it meant customs, such as child reading customs, recipes. She was the first editor to have a recipes section in her publication. And her magazine, Godey's Ladies Book, was one of the first magazines to circulate nationwide. So it meant that women all around the country, this new country, were reading her work and being influenced by it.
Yeah, it's important to mark in education, which you mentioned, when she started pushing for education of women, only half of American women could read. And there was not a single institution of higher learning in this country that would admit women.
That's exactly right. Sarah Hale was probably, well, she was certainly one of the best educated women in the early part of the 19th century. She had been homeschooled by her mother and then by her brother, who went off to Dartmouth and would come home at vacations and teach Hale everything he had learned at Dartmouth. But as you mentioned, there was no institute of higher education for women. And one of the things Hale did was she kept stressing in her work that women were the intellectual equals of men. And if only they had the same kind of education, they would be able to perform as well in the professions as men were. She supported women as teachers. For example, in the 1820s, men were teachers, and women were, if they taught, were considered capable of teaching small children, but not the more difficult subjects to older kids. And how could you expect a woman to manage active boys in her classroom? Well, she went on to show that this was possible and even desirable.
You mentioned that she wrote the first anti-slavery novel, Northwood. which is interesting, because if you ask people today what novel that would be, pretty much everybody would say it was Harriet Beecher Stowe, a writer who she first published along with Edgar Allan Poe and Nathaniel Hawthorne. Everybody would say it was Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. How did this first book get sort of lost in our history?
You know, that's an interesting question. I guess I would say it's a hard read for a modern reader, but so is Uncle Tom's Cabin. It's a very good question, and I don't know enough about how the publishing industry for books worked back then. But, you know, you can still find it online, but it's certainly not in print anymore. And I should mention that she wrote many books and many, many articles, millions of words over the course of her long career. The Yale collected her works and determined that she had written and published more than 125 books over the course of her long life. But Northwood certainly hasn't lived on.
Well, there's a lot more to find out about the woman who was the mother of this Thanksgiving holiday coming up on the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. This is the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross, and we're talking with Melanie Kirkpatrick, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and former deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, and the author of Lady Editor, the story of Sarah Josepha Hale and the making of the modern American woman, as well as the book Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience, and how that woman and that holiday are forever linked.
In Northward, there is a chapter about a New England Thanksgiving Day. And in my view, it's the best writing on our holiday, about the meaning of our holiday in all of American literature. She has a magnificent description of the food that people ate and the kind of the conviviality, how people gathered together on the day. The device that she used to describe this is, has a New England family is entertaining an Englishman who is new to our country, and so they have to describe to him what Thanksgiving is all about. And yes, turkey was on the menu in her Thanksgiving way back then.
So let's get to her role in this holiday. Even though this will come as a surprise, I think, to most listeners, it would not be an exaggeration to say the reason why we nationally mark this day was Sarah Josepha Hale, somebody who most Americans were probably never heard of.
Yes. Thanksgiving was essentially a New England holiday originally. And it, as New Englanders traveled west to explore the frontiers of America, they took the holiday with them. So that's one reason the holiday began to spread. At the time that Sarah Hale was writing, in the early part of the 19th century, the 1820s, 30s, 40s, most states had a Thanksgiving Day. It was called by the governor of the state, and it could be any day between September and December. The point being that Americans didn't celebrate on the same day. And there was a marvelous saying that you could have a Thanksgiving Day, a good Thanksgiving dinner every week between Election Day and Christmas Day if you planned your travel itinerary correctly. So she thought that Americans should come together on the same day, and she set out to make that happen using the power of Godey's Lady's Book to express her idea and get governors and the public to sign on to it. In addition, she had a private letter writing campaign that she wrote to the governors of every state and to congressmen and to other influential figures trying to persuade them to support her idea.
It says something of her influence at the time in American culture, that at a time when, frankly, most men in power would see, and especially in politics, at a time women could not even vote, would, you know, ignore a letter from a woman came that would come to them asking them to do anything. Hers were opened. Hers were read. Hers had influence.
Exactly. She wrote to presidents of the United States who wrote back to her. Unfortunately, before Lincoln, the response was always, "We like your idea, but no, the president doesn't have the authority under the Constitution to call such a day." Even though George Washington, as Hale pointed out, even though George Washington had done so in 1789. But so they said that the presidents who responded to her said that that authority was left to the governors of the individual states.
Now, Lincoln gets the credit, as well he should, for officially making it a national holiday. But the idea and the decades of pushing for it did come from Hale. Why was she so enamored of Thanksgiving? What did she think a national celebration of Thanksgiving on the same day nationwide could do, where it was so important to her?
She talked about the moral influence of the holiday, that Americans would step back and take the time to think about their blessings, what we should be grateful for as a nation, as a family, individually. She also saw it as a time for families to come together. She obviously, as an editor of a woman's magazine, she was very interested in family life and in the role of the wife and mother in a family. She thought of Thanksgiving in part as a more female holiday. The only other holidays, I should point out, that America had at the time were George Washington's birthday in February, and of course the 4th of July. So there was another factor in calling for a Thanksgiving holiday, which was that there was a holiday, a national holiday in February, there was another one in July, and it'd be nice to have one in the fall. Christmas wasn't celebrated, by the way, as a national holiday until the 1870s.
Although we could get into a conversation about Sarah Josepha Hale with Christmas as well, because if we look at our Christmas trees, we should also be thinking of Sarah Josepha Hale.
Precisely. Yeah, she was the one who introduced the idea of a Christmas tree to America and made it popular.
Okay, so the first to put recipes in books, the person who started introducing American writing to Americans, the person who pushed hard for women to be educated, even for things we won't have time to talk about, like wearing white as a wedding dress, Sarah Josepha Hale. How is this woman then mostly forgotten?
I've struggled with that question, and I think there are a couple of answers. She was an editor for 50 years. She retired just a couple of years before her death in 1877. And I think a few things happened. One is that the country got ahead of her, that they accepted her ideas about education and about employment for women. And there was, of course, a suffrage movement that was gaining power. But Hale did not think that women should vote. And her reason is interesting. She thought that they could be more influential over politics, advising the men in their family, than they could be getting into the rough and tumble of politics, where they would have to compromise. Politics was a dirty business, and who can argue with that? And she thought that women could rise above it and keep their eyes on the most important issues. So that's one reason. Today it's very hard for Americans, I think, to feel sympathetic to a woman who was anti-suffrage as I might add, were a majority of women of her era. Another reason is because Godey's Lady's Book kind of fell apart after her death, and it became a much more trivial, not very consequential magazine. And finally, in the 1890s, it closed. So, and she perhaps was unfairly associated with that magazine. People forgot about her influence in the 1820s, 30s, and 40s when it came to educating women.
There are also things that seem at odds with one another, at least to our culture today in the 21st century. So there seems to be a paradox with her character, at least as we look at it now. Can you explain that?
She was a very practical woman, Gil, and she recognized with great clarity, I think, that she had to make tough decisions about her life. And she chose to leave her four younger children with family members. They were dispersed among a couple of family members, and for the benefit of earning a living so that she could educate them. She wouldn't have been able to afford to send them to college if she hadn't, or educate them in other ways if she hadn't taken that job. So, the pain of that separation is very clear in her writing as she got older.
It's an amazing story. It's somebody who is important in our history, important for the discovery of several writers, for holidays, for things that we take for granted at weddings, at holidays, for things we see in magazines, and of course for Thanksgiving, and a name that I'm glad you have brought back to currency. Melanie Kirkpatrick is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, former deputy editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. And again, if you have interest in this, which I think you probably do at this point, the author of two terrific books about this day, Lady Editor, the story of Sarah Josepha Hale and the making of the modern American woman, and Thanksgiving, the holiday at the heart of the American experience. Melanie, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you too. Good to be with you.
We have more for you now, the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. There are many parts of celebrating Thanksgiving we refer to as holiday traditions, but just as Thanksgiving is a national holiday, it took a couple of hundred years to happen, what we call traditions, obviously at one time were not. So, how did what we know as Thanksgiving develop? Now, I don't ask such questions on these specials unless I have somebody who can give us answers. It's hard to fill up 3 hours with rhetorical questions. And that's why history professor Matthew Dennis is here from the University of Oregon. He is also the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, an American Calendar. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Thanksgiving fascinates me, and not just for turkey, friends, and football, but this is a holiday really rich in American history. Just as there's a lot of sheer contentment in this day, there's also a lot of our culture wrapped in on it, not always something that will leave people contented.
Thanksgiving is as old as it gets. I mean, it dates to the to the colonial period, and in fact, is pretty much universal in human cultures. Most societies take time out to thank whoever, a higher being or their communities or each other for whatever bounty they have. And in American history, it's ensconced in the origin myth of the pilgrims, and goes all the way up to the present, and is one of those traditions that's constantly transforming itself based on some kind of basic foundations, which it turns out, even though they're very traditional and filled with kind of mythic ballast, are nonetheless quite flexible and amenable to the transformations in American culture over the last several hundred years.
Yeah, and even though on another great American holiday steeped in history, July 4th, we have pretty much kept the same kind of conversation going for all of this time. It's different on Thanksgiving, the other day where we talk about actual American history. This is evolving more than other days.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been evolving from the beginning. I mean, one of the things about it is it's a kind of self-made grassroots holiday that's been kind of supported and institutionalized at various times. The key moment is we'd point to the Civil War right before in 1863 when Abraham Lincoln in his proclamation kind of created it as a national holiday, but it existed a long time before, and it transformed from really the 17th century up to the middle of the 19th century, and then it continued to transform into the second half of the 19th century, became in a way kind of less political, but always had that potential to be politicized. And yet Americans really kind of don't want it to be politicized. They want it to be this kind of haven from politics and the world, while also actually bringing the world in. It's a really interesting, complicated amalgam of tradition and innovation. And it's been that way from the start.
Yeah. And before we go back to the beginnings of Thanksgiving and all, this is interesting in that even though it's a national holiday and it starts off with, the big parades in New York and Philadelphia and such, it really is a national holiday that's mainly a private day. We spend it at home. We spend it with family and friends. We generally, unless it's a football game, and even there, it's mostly, wherever the TV is in our house. It's a day where we're all doing the same thing, not necessarily together, but we're doing the same sort of thing, eating the same sort of food at the same time. So it's this big national holiday. It's also this very special private day.
Yeah, it's a day filled with paradox. As you said, it's a public holiday, a national holiday, and it's profoundly private. It's national in scope, but really local and decentralized in the way that we celebrate it. It's a kind of inward-looking, family, community-centered, but it's also inclusive and outward-looking. Thanksgiving tends to be the time when people most often think to volunteer at soup kitchens and think about those less fortunate as they're trying to celebrate their own good fortune. It's kind of nationalistic, but it's also pluralistic. That is, you celebrate it at home in a way that doesn't necessarily contradict who you are individually or as an ethnic or racial or religious group. So it has this kind of almost sacred quality, but it's sometimes even religious quality, but it's non-sectarian and it's ecumenical. It's something that that faiths that often don't agree with each other on anything can nonetheless celebrate not to get together necessarily, but at the same time in their own houses and communities. So it has this historical template that's accessorized over time by Americans in ways that help them kind of create a sense of belonging, but not in a way that costs them, kind of sense of who they are.
The history of this holiday is not quite as traditional as you would think. We'll hear more about that coming up on the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. Good to have you back for more of the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. We've been hearing about how this day became so special from Matthew Dennis, a professor at the University of Oregon. He is also the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, an American Calendar. The Pilgrims and Puritans, once major symbols of this day, are somewhat falling off the radar now as far as holiday decorations and school plays are concerned, with people just kind of thinking, yeah, everybody get together for a nice dinner, but really being more concerned with how we're treating each other now than going back and dressing up as pilgrims and the history of all of that. There's somewhat of a feeling of, yeah, the history's sort of a mess, but this is a wonderful day.
Well, it's interesting. It's another one of those paradoxes. One of the things that we celebrate at Thanksgiving is an immigrant story, a migrant story of people arriving in this wilderness and finding opportunity and liberty and prosperity. But it's also actually a native story, and it's getting that way more and more. And so people are more and more conscious, I think, of native perspectives and that there were people here before, that this land wasn't free and open for colonization necessarily. And so I think that this kind of evolution of consciousness is there. It doesn't necessarily have to be front and center at every Thanksgiving table. Just the simple fact of getting together, being generous, being kind, being inclusive, and just focusing on the most important aspects of one's life often, which is, you know, family and immediate friends, is there. But I mean, these other myths or other historical context are there, and they don't necessarily contradict the thing that people are doing on their own. And that's kind of a unique phenomenon.
Yeah, it is. And you mentioned the fact that other cultures have embraced this. People have come to this country. You mentioned that it was an immigrant experience to a certain extent. You had the pilgrims who were immigrants at that time, with people who were at that time a majority, later a minority, you know, getting together. I mean, the pilgrims were real immigrant minority, or were thrown the heck out of England, where they were despised, and sat down. This day was accepted by people as they tried to assimilate into being Americans, because unlike so many other holidays, this was a day about being welcomed by those who already lived here. It became very popular with immigrants to America in the 20th century. This was part of becoming Americans, was to abandon your own foods for a day and eat what everybody else was going to eat and celebrate this day where everybody else was celebrating.
There were prescriptive elements about it. I mean, you know, the school curriculums in cities like New York would try to emphasize this as a kind of way of Americanizing immigrants. But the thing about it was that it didn't actually cost immigrants very much. And so, yeah, they could have turkey, which might be a unique dish for them. But there was no preventing them from, mixing in other kinds of side dishes. There's no one kind of monitoring the dinner table at these individual residences. And so it allowed people a lot of leeway and liberty in terms of creating their own way to be American. And they're just as American as anyone else when they're celebrating Thanksgiving in their own homes. And that's something they could hang their hat on. It was real. And it was a way that many communities did in fact, become more American, along with things like, baseball and such.
And you could invite the neighbors over, and nobody was going to look at the table if you were recent immigrants going, what the heck is that? It was going to be turkey. It was going to be sweet potatoes. It was going to be stuffing. There was going to be, maybe pecan pie, maybe pumpkin pie, apple pie. But there was going to be things where you can invite the neighbors who were still wondering how much of an American you had become. And it's like, oh, look at this. And that was important to a lot of people.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, like American culture, one of the great things about American culture is American food, which is in fact the incorporation of just about every great cuisine around the world. And so any Thanksgiving dinner is going to be better if it has, some sog paneer or some tamales or risotto or, who knows what, beyond the turkey and the squash and the, potatoes. Every society pretty much has their own form of bread, and there's no reason why naan couldn't be on the table along with some kind of classic Yankee biscuits.
You mentioned also it was a day where we looked after the less fortunate. That's so interesting. I did for years on a radio station in San Francisco, took over what we would do every year, which was broadcast our entire show from St. Anthony's, where they were serving Thanksgiving dinner and raise money, not just for that day, but for the year-long care of people who would come to places like St. Anthony's and other places around the Bay Area to get food 365 days a year. People feel the need to share. It really, Thanksgiving brings out the best of us. How did that develop, or do we even know how that developed?
Well, the original Thanksgiving, the real event that actually became mythologized, was a three-day harvest home festival, a harvest festival, in the fall of 1621, where Native people, who outnumbered the pilgrims by at least 2-1, came together and shared their food. The native people showed up bringing venison and a lot of other meats, and you know, the pilgrims, they had raised some vegetables and stuff. It was a kind of a potluck, and so, you know, it was this, you know, kind of sharing event. By the by the middle of the 19th century, you could see in illustrations in the major weeklies and periodicals of the time, the classic kind of middle-class household, patriarch sitting in a chair reading a paper, women getting everything together, and some poor naif like sitting on the chair, being brought into the Thanksgiving table and being fed off the bounty of more fortunate Americans. And you can see this motif, you know, go on and on. So, you know, during the second half of the 19th century, when American was industrializing and commercializing in new ways, you know, there were often like turkey giveaways. You know, the poultry industry, you know, was promoting sort of things, and shopkeepers would give away turkeys and have turkey trots where you could, you know, they'd release in certain communities, they'd release a bunch of turkeys off of the roof of a shop or some kind of building, and people would run after them, and then that would evolve into races and things. But I think it's just like the focus on thanks brings to people's awareness, apparently, in unique ways, that what little they have, they're thankful for. They know that some people have less, and so it's to kind of celebrate what they have. They often look outward and try to find ways to make their community better. Because after all, it is a community event. And even though it's celebrated individually, this is one of those outreach aspects of it that is really remarkable.
It is a beloved American holiday. In many polls, it comes up as the most beloved American holiday. And it is a day where we share, which is very unique in American traditions. Matthew Dennis is a history professor from the University of Oregon. He's also the author of Red, White, and Blue Letter Days, an American Calendar. Matthew, thank you so much for being with us. Have a great Thanksgiving.
My pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving to you and everyone out there.
Stay right here for more of the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. Welcome back to the Thanksgiving special from CBS News Radio. I'm Gil Gross. How do you get ready for unexpected guests? I mean, other than, you know, turning out the lights and taping a Beware Vicious Dog sign on the door. And we're talking with Stephen Orr, the editor-in-chief of Better Homes and Gardens. Someone with your job would be my worst nightmare for an unexpected guest. I'd be afraid you'd just be looking around my house going, wrong color, not centered, bad fabric. How do you deal with just the idea? Because I know this really hits a lot of people. People come over for their first time, and they might be critical of their house.
I want people to be able to live the way they want to live. And at Better Homes and Gardens, I think what we're always trying to help people with is being happy, as happy as they can be in their homes. So I think most of us love our homes. Most of us realize that there's always something to make better, right? So that's what we're talking about here is when people come over, nothing's perfect. My house isn't perfect. You know, it's kind of like there's many things in my house that make no sense. I'd say one of the things, Gil, I think of psychologically about it is when you do have people over, whether they're expected or invited or dropping by, it does kind of make you see your house in new ways. You know what I mean? And that's good for us because it's good. We get used to the way things are. And sometimes I'll have people over for a dinner party and they'll leave. And the next day I look around and I'm like, I didn't even explain why that weird, you know, piece of furniture sitting in that weird spot because it's not meant to be there. You know, you don't want to make excuses, but also sometimes things are in progress or you haven't gotten around to something. I think we all just, you know, in this day and age, of course, need to give each other a break, really. So I don't think most people are being hypercritical. I think as we know about our own self-criticism, we care more than everyone else does about that stuff. So I think just let people come over. You know, if things are a bit messy, you know, so be it.
So people are coming over, and let's exclude the, I've planned this for months. This was the thing. People are flying in from out of town. I know that. And isn't this going to be great? So when hosting something that's kind of impromptu like that, what should people be aware of?
Well, I think, you know, the idea of dropping in depends on where you live. Like in New York City, people don't drop in, right? And that's where I live. But also I've lived other places where it's in a neighborhood, and like I've lived in Des Moines, Iowa, and people will stop by. And so I think during the holidays, you might, depending on where you live, you might expect that people might drop by. So having a few things ready for them is always a good idea. So having a few, you know, some cheese and crackers in the fridge that you can grab and put on a board with a little, you know, fig jam that you have in the, you know, having a few little bits and pieces just kind of in advance with the knowledge that people might drop by is a great idea. Create a space where your home, if you live in a place where people drop in, where your home is drop-inable. That's not a word, but, you know, where people, where you feel okay with people popping in. And so that things are generally kind of tidy, but not everything's super clean. You know, obviously when people drop by, you're not taking them into your bedroom necessarily. You're not taking them into your own private bathroom, but you want to make sure that if there's a downstairs powder room, that it's fairly tidy. So I do think that psychology of being ready, but not perfect is the way I would do it.
Thank you, Stephen Orr. This has been the Thanksgiving Day special from CBS News Radio, produced by District Productive and Paul Woody Woodhull with Hunter Sense. I'm Gil Gross.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.